people asked me who was speaking, and I said, well, I had asked Butch, and almost everyone of them said, you know, I've heard him many times at the Loving Black Meeting, but I've never heard his full story. So anyway, I think we're in for the treat today. Butch W.
Hey, Butch.
Fortunately for me, I knew where to come back. And that's going to be part of my story, too. I came back in here. I'm going to take you back to my roots. Born and raised here in San Antonio, raised on the south side of San Antonio. Went to the Harlandale School Systems, graduated from Harlandale High School in 1962. I was a war baby, as my mama called me. I was born in 1944, the big war. And I was given the name on my birth certificate of Garland Christopher Woods III. My daddy had been Garland Christopher Woods Jr. And he begged my mother not to name me that. Please don't do that to that boy. Because my dad had always gone by GC. Everybody knew him by GC. Don't name that boy that. I hate that name. Oh, I think it's a pretty name, she said. So that's what I became. Sure enough, when I was about 7 years old, I came in with a knot on my head that I'd gotten from some guy making fun of me and my name. And my dad said, what happened to you? And I told him, you know, this boy started making fun of me and everything. She said, he looked at my mother and he said, you see? Told you, and he's not going to be Garland anymore. He's going to be Butch from now on. So that's how that name Butch came about. The only guy that I ever knew that would go by the name Garland on the south side was Garland Winter, and he was the toughest son of a bitch I ever knew in my life. That's the only reason why I even go by that name. But I grew up in a middle-class family. Everybody on the south side in those days, back in those days in the 50s, they were middle-class people. And when you grow up in a middle-class neighborhood, you learn real quick how to take care of yourself. You better. Because somebody will be back today to mess with you again. So I always was able to take care of myself pretty well. My dad worked at they were great people. My dad worked at the same job for 38 years. He worked over the stockyards at Swifton Company, the big meat packing company. My mother was a housewife. That's when, you know, they took care of the house. My mother was my buddy. My daddy, I always thought, was really a hard ass, you know. But if I went to my mother, I could always get my boy. So I become a mama's boy real quick. But if you called me a mama's boy, you'd probably have a fist fight on your hand, you know. So part of my story is this, and I hope some of y'all can relate to this. From my earliest thoughts as a young kid, I'd look out and I'd see other people, and I felt like I just did not quite fit in. I think that's a trait that most alcoholics have. It's deep down inside, it's low self-worth, low self-esteem. We don't feel quite as good as, you know? And the other thing is, we're extremely selfish and self-centered people. So that kind of fuels that. My dad was a good man, like I said. He went to his grave. Never told me he loved me one time. Never told me one time. And everything I did, it just seemed like it just wasn't quite good enough for him. Well, you should have done this. Well, you could have done that. So this self-worth stuff just keeps piling up on me. And he was a real baseball fan. I mean, he quote names and figures and stuff. And so early on, I said, you know what, maybe I can get his approval and start playing baseball. And I got pretty good at it. All-star Little League, All-star Pony League, All-star Babe Ruth League. Played some American Legion ball. But every time, it was just not quite good enough. Well, if you only done this. When I was 13 years old, he mentioned the fact that the good baseball players are going to be switch hitters from now on. You know? Not the kind of switch hitters that we're thinking about. So at 13 years of age, I taught myself how to bat right-handed and left-handed, which was pretty unique back then. I had a pretty good career to look forward to. When I was 16 years old, I had an injury to my Achilles tendon, which required a surgery, and my baseball career was over. So you can just imagine how the self-worth goes down even further. When I was about 16 years old, just coincidentally, I had these two brothers that I ran around with. I was raised with them. They're about a year and a half apart. And this one brother had a car. And back in those days, on Friday and Saturday night, where all the teenagers went, they went to a thing called drive-in theaters. For you young people, that's where a lot of teenagers did stuff for the first time, all kinds of first things. Anyway, we end up at this theater, and I didn't know this brother. He went back to the trunk, he opened it up, and he had 2 six-packs of beer. And we proceeded to start watching this movie and everything. And they drank 3 beers apiece. I drank the whole 6-pack and drove them home. Immediately, what happened was my self-worth just went like this, straight up. And I didn't need anybody's approval after I took that first drink. After I took that first drink, it changed the way I felt about me. And after the second one, it was even better. And after the third one, I didn't really care. And that's how my drinking career progressed. I went on into college here at San Antonio College. After about 2.5 years, I went over to St. Mary's. Never graduated. I got about 84 hours and was out drinking one night. Well, you know, you kind of gravitate. You find the people that drink just like you. You know, that's the ones you want to be around. I didn't trust people that couldn't drink. You know? Yeah. I never forget, we were out drinking one night and this guy looked over at me and he said, "What's your major anyhow, Butch?" And I said, "Well, history and government, you know, pre-law. My daddy wants me to be a lawyer." He said, "You know, you might ought to think about that." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, you know, lawyers like to argue. And you don't argue very well. You know, you argue just a little bit and you're going to kill somebody. It might be best you find something else." Well, that's all that I needed to hear. I found me at that time, you could find a pretty decent job. I found me a job. And, I'm going to go back to school, but I never did. About this time, you know, they introduced me to, you know, most of my drinking was like beer joints, dance halls, ice houses, even some other kind of houses that we don't really need to mention, you know, but anywhere where there was crazy people, you know, I wanted to be around it, you know, and my self-worth, it was great. And first time I ever had someone tell me I might have a drinking problem. I'll never forget this. This was, these guys introduced me. This one of them said one day, "Have you ever been to this place out east town called Eastwood Country Club?" And I said, "No, never been there." Well, Eastwood Country Club, what it was back in the 50s and 60s into the early 70s, most of the black entertainment in the South, they couldn't get bookings in regular nightclubs. So every city in the South, Houston, San Antonio, they had a black nightclub. They called it the Chipman Circuit, is what they called it. And man, they took me out there and I thought I'd die and go to heaven. You know, I mean, as long as you can carry a bottle of whiskey or whatever, everything, bring your own bottle. As long as you're big enough to carry a bottle, everything's fine. You know, I saw all kinds of unique entertainment, you know, Ike and Tina Turner, James Brown, the Supremes when they were the Supremes, you know, all kinds of stuff. And they had a real neat exotic dancer called Miss Wiggles. There's got to be somebody in this audience that remembers this, you know. This old gal could put on a show, man. She was a black lady, about, she was an old lady, about 50 years old. But man, could she put on a show? And kind of a sidebar of that, there was a guy that wrote in the Express and News for years, Paul Thompson. God rest his soul. He died as a sober member of this club right here. But he was kind of the gossip guy, you know, putting stuff in the paper. And he leaked it out. We had a DA at the time, a district attorney that was one of us, really, Charlie Leak. And he let it out that Charlie was messing around with Miss Wiggles. And that don't sound like much right now, but in the middle 60s for a white district attorney be messing around with a black exotic dancer, oh man. And I think she was filled up more. Filled up more now. And there was a big old guard there, black guard. Guy, he'd fill up that door when he'd walk in. He weighed about 400 pounds. And everybody called him Tiny. Tiny became my buddy, you know. And one night I was walking out of that place and I was carrying a pretty good load, you know, and he looked at me and he said, "You're carrying a big load tonight, aren't you, son?" And I said, "If you liked you, he called you son. If you didn't like you, he called you boy." And I said, "Oh, I'm okay." He said, "Why don't you let me walk you to the car?" So he walked me out to my car and he said, "Here, give me your keys and lay down in there and go to sleep. I'll wake you up when this place blows." It was getting close to 4 o'clock in the morning. At 4 o'clock in the morning, he knocked on the window and he said, "I had a cup of coffee for him." He handed it to me and he said, "I'm going to tell you something, son. That old booze is going to whip your ass if you don't watch yourself." And at the time, I was about 20 years old. And I drove all the way home thinking to myself, what does this big old black son of a bitch know? You know, I'm 20 years old and, you know, women, you know, and this and that. What the hell does he know? That's the first time somebody had told me I had a problem with drinking, and I didn't get sober until I was 43 years old. So you could just imagine all the stuff that happened in between. When I was about 20 years old, getting ready to turn 21, this dad of mine that I've told you about came down with terminal lung cancer, and he was dying. And, you know, just to show you how selfish and self-centered we become when we're drinking, my thoughts were, well, here's the final insult from this guy, the final non-approval. You're going to die on me. So I wouldn't even go to the hospital. Everybody would ask, where's Butch? I don't know. He's into that drinking right now. When he died, his funeral home was full of people. He was very well respected. Deep down inside, I wanted to someday have the same respect that this man had. Although, you know, I didn't think he respected me. I couldn't even cry at his funeral. Couldn't even shed a tear. Resentment, they call that. I didn't learn that until I got in this program. Deep-seated resentment. And I proceeded to just keep drinking. Every time I drank, it'd make it go away. Every time I drank, it, good things start happening. I had a lot of good times drinking. And then, you know, things start going sideways. I was 21 years old. I married my first wife. Lasted about 3 months. Probably should have just gotten an annulment. She called me one New Year's Eve, in fact, and said, I'm going to go back home to Mom. You know, I need to spend some time away from you. So I said, okay. So a couple more drinks later, I said, you know what? I need to help her. So I loaded up all her clothes, took it over and threw it on the front yard of her mama's house. That was the end of that marriage. And I went about 3 or 4 more years later, I married my second wife. And this is the lady that I was married to for 12 years, and I had my daughter by. My daughter now is 47 years old. And my drinking just progressed. It was always in these places where lots of chaos going on. Lots of, when we drink, our morals, for some reason, as alcoholics, our morals get kind of, George Brown used to say, we have the morals of an alley cat, you know? Things just got more and more crazy. And finally, we've got a divorce, and my daughter at that time was 7 years old when I divorced her mother. And I didn't get sober until she was 15. So she saw the last years of my drinking, which was pretty bad. Now, when I was about 14 years old, I want to mention this, go back a little bit. I got into a hobby that I was in for all of my life, just about. I got into a hobby of racing homing pigeons. It's a sport. Same pigeons that they use for messages during the war, and they evolved it into a sport. And I was 14 years old, and I met a guy that was 20 years old. And this guy, I looked at him, and I said, you know what, when I grow up, I hope I can be just like him. This guy was named Garland. Anybody that in this audience here that knew Garland, hold your hand up. I want y'all to look around. Wow. When this meeting's over, go up and ask these people, do you have a Garland story? Everybody's got one. And like I said, he was the only guy I ever knew that go by the name Garland on the south side. So, fast forwarding here, and what happened was 1986, I'd had a love-hate relationship with a lady, lasted about a year and a half. I'd gone to school with her, and I met up with her later. And in an alcoholic's drinking career, if he's fortunate to get to the bottom, he'll find a woman that drinks just like he does. And I found one. Oh boy, was that a hell of a deal. Fight, fuss, makeup. You know, that makeup shit. Fight, fuss, make up some more. And finally, after one episode, after about a year and a half, she just said, you know what? I don't want to have anything to do with you anymore when you're drinking. You need to do something about that drinking. You're crazy when you drink, especially when you drink that whiskey. I just don't want to be around you anymore. And I said, okay. And I usually could send her flowers, or I could send her something, and it would make it better again, you know. She wouldn't come back. And she kept telling me, you got to do something about that drinking. So I had a little light bulb go off in my head. I remembered that Garland had quit drinking. Now, how I knew about this, you know, some of our friends told us, that crazy son of a bitch is finally quit drinking. I tell you how bad he was when he drank. It'd take three good police officers to arrest him. He was an iron worker, worked iron all day. All those buildings that are downtown San Antonio, he worked on most of them. And he was stronger than three good men. And his drinking got real bad. Got so bad that one of his best friends he was in a pool game with, I speak about this now because he's dead now. One of his best friends in a pool game, they got into an argument, and Garland damn near killed him. They had to hit Garland over the head with a pool cue about three times to get him off of him. The guy was in a coma for 3 days and broke his jaw and knocked out about six teeth. He was a bad character when he would drink. And this guy was sober. Backing up just a little bit. About 5 years before then, I'd made a regular deal out of going to my mother's house every Friday and picking her up and taking her to lunch. That way, you know, I could put a touch on her for some money or whatever. I usually needed something. And she would say stuff like to me, like she'd say, "But if you know that stuff does that to you, why don't you leave it alone? Why don't you just have two or three and go home like most people?" And I'd find a spot on the floor to stare at and just, you know, I couldn't answer. I went over there one Friday and went in the kitchen there, and there's Garland sitting there. And Garland's been sober about 6 years at that time. And yet, you know, if you knew him, that grin that he had on his face. And whenever you see that grin, you knew he was getting ready to mess with you. And my mother said, "I've asked Garland to come over here. We're going to have lunch with us. Maybe he can talk some sense into you about that damn drinking." And old Garland looked at me and said, "Well, I don't know why to do that. I'll tell you what's happened to me." And I knew most of the stories he had. But he started telling me stuff that I didn't know of where it evolved to and everything. He was telling me. And my mother went over to the refrigerator. Open the refrigerator. And she reached in there, and some of you remember the old Lone Star long neck beers. Remember them old long necks? And she took one out of the refrigerator, and she's looking at it like this. And I said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "I'm looking on here to see what ingredient is in this stuff that makes you such a dumb shit when you drink it." and of course, Barbara kind of laughed a little bit. We had a real nice lunch. Told me all this stuff, but you know what? I wasn't ready. In the back of my head, I'd say stuff like, "If I ever get as bad as him, I'll probably need to go to that A&A stuff." You know? And sure enough, after this incident happened with this lady that wouldn't come back, I said, "Well, I'll go down there to that Club 12 where he goes, and I'll see, you know, start going to some of those meetings, and I'll see if I can get her to come back." But I came in here and here's what I sat here at one of these tables, you know. He looked at me and said, I was wondering how long it was going to take you to get here. And he said, what's going on? And I started telling him about this lady, you know. And he said, well, she might come back, she might not. He said, but why don't you just do this? Why don't you just go inside here, this office? God rest her soul, June Spencer was there. And he said, buy yourself one of these big books. He's right here. Buy one of them. Okay, I bought it. He said, now give her $15. I said, why? He said, because you're going to be spending a lot of time here, and that's what the views are here. You're going to be a member of this club. Okay. So I gave it to him. I've been a member ever since. And I'm going to tell y'all right now, if you come to Club 12 and you've ever got anything out of coming to a meeting at Club 12, you need to be a member of this club. We've really got something special here that most cities don't have. This place saved my life. So anyhow, I started going to meetings and I started reading the book. Now I gotta warn you all newcomers about this book called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's our textbook, written by an alcoholic for alcoholics. Okay? I gotta warn you about it. Don't try to read it while you're still drinking. It'll mess you up real bad. Okay? I gotta warn you also, if you read the first 164 pages, you're probably gonna catch alcoholism if you're an alcoholic. You're gonna catch it. Okay? I gotta also warn you that there's no psychobabble bullshit in this thing. There's nothing about your inner child, your issues, or anything like that. What there is precise directions on how to get sober and stay sober and live sober. So I got one of these books and I started reading it. I started going to meetings. But I wasn't ready. I'd read it and I'd say, yeah, I couldn't identify. All I wanted was to get that woman back. Then after about 2 months, I found out why that woman wouldn't come back. She'd taken up one of my best friends who left his wife for her. Oh, shit. Smoke started coming out of my ears. You know how we are in this thing called resentment. And we can share a lot of things, but we don't share a lot of stuff, you know. That's not right, you know. So I came in here and I started telling old Garland about it, you know. And just so happened, the old guy was coming walking in. Bill Blankenship. He was about 30-some-odd years sober then, 1986, which meant he got sober back in the 50s. And he said, Bill, Butch has got a real situation here. Tell him about it, Butch. And so I started telling him. Old Bill looked at me and he said, you know what, Butch? Over there at North Star Mall, they got one of those Hallmark card places. You need to go over there and get two real nice thank you cards and mail it to both of them. Because they've got your problem now. You don't have it anymore. Everybody went, ha, ha, ha. You know, I didn't think it was a bit damn funny. And I was able to stay sober about one more week. Because, you know, this resentment stuff was in me. And what I finally figured out after those 2 months was my problem was hard liquor, whiskey. I'll just leave that alone and I'll just drink beer. That lasted about a week and a half. And I was back over again. Now this is a part of my story I'm really proud of, but I'm sharing it because this is the insanity that sets in with alcoholics. I started making plans how I was going to get even with these two people. I'm talking about getting even to hurt them. I'd gone as far as going over to Auschwitz at that time. I bought one of those little small aluminum Little League baseball bats. And I knew where they stayed, and I was going to pull them to the curb, and I was going to try to break every bone I possibly could. But there was a little deal in my head kept saying, I don't know if you really want to go to the penitentiary, and I'd probably end up killing one of them. And I finally found a solution. I was over here at the old Dallas nightclub. Some of y'all might remember that. That was a carpeted sewer for country and western music, you know. I'm in there, you know, drinking in there, everything, trying to find another honky-tonk angel, you know. And I look over and I see this guy that I was raised with on the south side. That was always, he was a tough guy when we were coming up, and then he turned into one of those guys. He went from tough to being mean, and then if they graduate, live long enough, they go from mean to being bad. And this guy was a bad character. He was he turned into an enforcer for most of the bookies here and then. Anybody ever had a bet that went bad, well, they'd send him collecting. And I went over to him and told him the story, and I said, I got $400 on me. I'll give you that money, and I'm going to take a trip with some friends to Las Vegas or somewhere, and I want you to break as many bones as you can. And he did me a favor. Didn't realize at the time. He looked at me and he said, if you feel the same way in 90 days, come back and see me. He said, hell, I'll break your neck for you. He said, why don't you just give it about 90 days? The best advice I ever had, because within about a week, I found another honky-tonk angel. It was all over. And the insanity of drinking just got more and more. And I'm going to tell you something else about this book here. When you read it and you go out and you do some more drinking, it will mess up your drink. It's never the same. Never the same. You wake up in the morning and you say something, oh, shit, do that. You know? And finally, and like I said, on the 23rd of January, it got to where I was having blackouts all the time. And I woke up that morning and said, I just can't do this anymore. And I came back in here, and there's old Garland sitting there again. And he's grinning at me. He said, had enough now? And I said, yeah, I think so. He said, no, thinking is not for you, but you're too damn smart. You have to be, like this book says, you have to be convinced to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic and that your life is unmanageable. And if you can't do that, go out that door and get some more. And when you're through, if you live long enough, come back. I said, no, no, I'm through. He said, well, good. Go get us 2 cups of coffee and we'll start working. So I went over there and I got coffee. And at that time, this is 1988. And Carol is working there with Ronald. And I hear you hear all this all stuff. You newcomers that didn't know Carol talked to somebody after me. She was like our mama. She took care of us. And I walked up there to get that coffee, and she looked at me and she said, Butch, I'm so glad to see you back. Now you pay attention to Garland and you do what he tells you to do. You hear me? I got these 2 cups of coffee, and I come back and I sit down and I give them to him, and I said, Garland, she remembered my name. It's been 2 years. How the hell she do that? Garland looked at me and said, well, Bush, she might be one of those people that walk around all day and think about somebody other than herself. Uh-oh. Of course, I'm quite perplexed at his. Well, I've always had a problem with names. He said, most selfish and self-centered assholes do. He said, we're going to be dealing with that selfish and self-centeredness probably for a long time. And then this journey started. I want you to read 5 pages a day and call me and let's talk about it. Okay? I want you to go to a meeting every day.
Tell my wife's secret to some of my grandson.
And I want you to sit down in a meeting, and I want you to keep your mouth shut until you work these first 9 steps with me. And of course, that kind of hurt my feelings because I thought I had a lot of wisdom. You know? He said, you don't know anything about living sober and staying sober. The only thing you know about is how to get drunk and show your ass in public, and all those people know how to do that. So, okay. Now, here's the other thing, too. When you go home tonight, I want you to get out on your knees before you go to bed. And all you have to do is say one word. Please. And when you get up in the morning, before you even go to the bathroom, get down on your knees and say two words. Thank you. And I started doing it. And he said, then by the way, also make your bed. I said, well, what does that have to do with staying sober? He said, you're going to start being responsible for your actions. If you mess that bed up, you make it up. Well, shit, I've never made my bed in my life. I always had a mama or some woman or somebody make my bed for me, you know? So that's how this journey began. And we started going through these steps. And what he did for me on this first step, and I do this to this day with new people. He went and got a piece of paper from James Spencer. It was a legal pad paper, and he drew a line down the middle of it. He said, I want you to write on this side over here all the things that you can have, all the bad things that you can ever think of that happened to you in your life. Okay? And put a check mark over the other side. There's alcohol and drugs were involved in any way. And I'll be back in 30 minutes. He wouldn't let me take it home. He would sit there and do it right then because he knew I wouldn't do it. So I started writing stuff and all kinds of stuff. And putting on that piece of paper. When I come back, he looked at it, and of course about 90% of all that stuff was alcohol was involved in some way. He looked at it and he said, that tells me that's first step. He said, you know, your life becomes unmanageable when you drink alcohol. That's first step, Butch. Now all you want to do is fold it up nice, put it in your wallet, and you carry it in your wallet until I tell you different. And anytime you think about going to the ice house or something to get a drink or whatever, you pull that fitting vest out and you take a look at it. And remember, that's where it's going to take you. So, that was the first step. Started going to meetings, reading the book. Read down to about page 62 of Selfishness and Self-Centeredness. And he said, how long have you been sober now, Bruce? I said, well, about 60 days. He said, you know, we need to talk about this second and third step. About, you know, that there's a power greater than yourself that can return you to sanity. I said, I'm not insane. He said, then hell you're not. When it comes to alcohol, you're insane, and that's what we're talking about, your sanity. You know, have you read the three guys in the book? My favorite one was the jaywalker, you know, in New York City that kept jaywalking and getting run over. And normal people look at him and say, what the hell's wrong with him? You know? Well, your mama's been saying that to you for years. What's wrong with you? I said, well, okay. He said, so now we're going to have to do this third step, which is, you know, you're going to have to make the decision to turn your will and your life over here. And I said, you know, I can't get into that religion stuff. He said, I'm not talking about religion. Yeah, but you know, my mama, she made me go to Sunday school with her and all that kind of stuff when I was 16 years old. The only thing I can remember about, you know, God was there was a guy every Sunday walking around with a Bible in his hand, shaking it at me and hollering, and I don't want any of that shit. He said, no, we're not talking about that. What kind of God would you like to have, Butch? You choose right now. Which one would you like to have? Well, I don't know. He said, well, tell me. And the only thing I could think of to get him off of me was, well, I'd like to have one I could talk to just like I'm talking to you. He said, that's your God, man. Start talking to him. And your will, you know what your will is? I said, what? It's your thoughts. So you need to turn your thoughts over to this God of your own understanding. And then we proceeded to do the fourth step. Didn't take long when he got moving. And we make a list when we do a four-step. We make a list of our fears, resentments, moral inventory. Moral means, you can look that up in the dictionary, what that means. The difference between right and wrong is what it means. And so I made this resentment list, and guess who was number one on that resentment list? This dad of mine. And I told him why. And he asked me, he said, let me ask you something. any of his brothers and sisters still alive? I said, yeah. He said, why don't you go talk to him? See where he came from. And I found out stuff that I'd never knew. My dad was a product of the Great Depression. And you talk about hard people. 30% of the United States didn't have a job. You had to get hard to survive. So he just shut down emotionally. And finally, you know, he had a mother that was just real emotionally abusive to everybody. So he didn't show his emotions. That's why he went to his grave and never said, I love you. Yeah. So when I did my fifth step, and we talked about that, and he said, you know, you need to understand that he's doing the best he possibly can. When we got to the eighth and ninth step, I made a list of people I need to make amends to. And he said, well, that looks good, this eighth step, but there's one guy missing here. You don't have your dad over there. I said, how do you make amends to somebody that's been dead for over 20 years? He said, why don't you try writing him a letter? Write him a letter and tell him what you found, the way you felt, what you found out, and that you, you know, forgive him. So I did that, and the tears that I never had before just came the minute I started writing. I took it back to him, and he looked at it, and he said, that's great. Why don't you take it out there to the cemetery and read it to him, which I did. Finally, I had some peace over that. This is something that if you don't have these kind of things, if you don't handle them, that's why we have a fourth and fifth step. If you don't have them, handle them, this is the stuff that keeps you that low self-esteem and returns you right back to life again. I've had a lot of life situations that happened since I've been sober. I've got about 6 minutes here. I want to cover this. When I came in this program, I was on my third drunk marriage. I tried to keep that together for about a year, year and a half, and it finally went away. It was too much damage. And I felt like, you know, marrying for me is just that, you know, I was one of those drunks when I drank, I couldn't stay married for some reason. Actually, what it was, I was so damn sorry. Nobody would want to stay with me, the stuff that I would pull. And I met this real nice lady in this program who had been married to one of my friends. I'd only been married about 2 years, and some of y'all remember Jean. And Jean died of cancer, and this lady's name was Mary Alice. And, about a year and a half later, we started dating, and we got married. And we were married for about 10 years. And it was one of the best relationships I've ever had, you know. And, she had some problems when she went in to have her gallbladder removed, and she came out and told me that her gallbladder was bad, but also she had pancreatic cancer. And about 7.5 months time, she was dead. And I just about knocked all the air out of me. You know, and all I knew is I keep coming back to this fellowship, real friends. Because when she was in the hospital, I never will forget, her son came down to be with us. He was in the Coast Guard at the time, chief of the Coast Guard. And this stream of people started coming in to visit Mary Alice. And finally, Gary looked at me one day and he said, you know what, Rich? He said, you guys have got the damnedest bunch of friends I've ever seen in my life. I've never seen a bunch like this. People with tattoos. And I said, yeah, but they all got that same look in their eye, don't they? He said, what's that? I said, they've had a spiritual awakening as a result of doing these steps. He said, you know, my mama always said I need to go to Al-Anon. Will you take me to an Al-Anon meeting? And I did, and he continued to go to Al-Anon. 2 years after Mary Alice died, he called me, and he had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And he was dead. These are life situations. I just knew drinking was going to solve anything, and the fellowship would help me. And I just kept coming back about a year and a half later. We all went out to dinner lunch one day. Sylvia had a new sponsee. The lady sat down beside me and we started talking, and about a year and a half later, we got married. And that's my wife. Be 15 years in April. So I tell people ask me, how many times you've been married, Butch? And I said, 5 times. And they go, oh, well, wait a minute, you need to hear the rest of the story. 3 of them were drunk marriages, and 2 of them have been sober marriages. I've been sober for 30 years. I've been married 26 years at that time. It's been really nice. We'll close with this. This guy, Garland, was my sponsor through all this stuff. He touched so many lives. The first meeting I went to, went about 30 minutes, and the chairperson said, Garland, would you like to share? And Garland started talking. And it was like you could hear a pin drop in that room. I couldn't believe it. This guy is what a same guy that I've known for years. And when the meeting was over, I went outside with him and I said, what the hell has happened to you? You don't even sound like the same guy. He said, I've had a psychic change, Butch. It was brought on by the spiritual experience that I had by doing the first 9 steps in this program. I promise you, if you do those first 9 steps, it's going to happen to you. And it did. Garland came down with cancer and fought it one time. 15 years later, came back. And he made 40 years of sobriety, July the 9th. And 7 days later, he died. The day before he died, I talked to Garland. I called him and I said, how you doing, Bob? And that typical humor he had, he said, well, I think I'm headed for the last roundup. That's the old cowboy movie stuff, you know? And I said, really? And he said, yeah, I don't think I have too much left. And I said, well, is there anything I can do for you? Yeah. He said, keep going to those meetings and make sure those meetings stay in the solution. You know? Remember, meetings are for solutions, either to offer solutions or to listen to solutions. And if you got any problems, you bring them to me. He said, get yourself a sponsor after I'm going. That's okay. And he said, one other thing. It's time for you to pass it on. And I said, man, you saved my life, Carl. He said, no. I didn't do that. I didn't ever have that power. Never had that power. What I did is I went through the steps, the first 9 steps, and you found a power greater than yourself, your own higher power, and that's what saved your life. It's your turn to pass it on, Bruce. I hope I've been able to pass on just a little bit today. Thank you.